This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Morin. Time to get back into the geek, my friends. We've talked a lot about ships, special effects, origins like the cloaking device. Now we dive deep into the space stations of Star Trek.
This is where we go, right? Now we're going to have some fun. So during the TV run, obviously, their budget didn't allow for like large creative space stations like the ones we observed in the movies, and most of the TV shows had the star bases on planets, except for
good old K-7, right on the Klingon border, storing some grain in their storage compartments, and just storage compartments, storage compartments. It's pretty much the entire station was made up of storage compartments.
The what?
But let's take a look at some of the space stations we got to see, and maybe we'll point out where they were used and reused from time to time across the Trekverse.
Yeah. You know, I enjoy going into these types of shows because obviously the original series is where it all began. And they use so much of what came out of the Star Trek original series movies and all the other series. It's a lot of cool space stations, right? So as we said before, we're not going to be talking about good old Starbase 12, which is used a lot. Let's start off with K-7. You remember the first time you saw K-7, Zach?
Trouble with Tribbles is one of those episodes that I don't really remember seeing for the first time. It's just something you always knew about in Star Trek. So I don't remember, like, oh, wow, look, there's a space station. Because usually in the original series, you're out there on the frontier. You don't run into other ships. When you do, they look just like yours because, you know, budget. But
that's right.
I liked how the fleet looked all the same. You know, that added a sense of continuity. You know, the budgetary constraints forced them to have a nice sense of continuity across the fleet. And, you know, whenever you see something that's not a Constitution-class starship on the original series, it's a big deal. So when you see K-7, you're like, oh, wow, this is a whole nother thing. This is a whole nother design. This is cool.
Yeah, and you know what? It was a unique design, I thought. It was kind of interesting. Its makeover helps it a lot, but I remember the first time seeing it going, wow, look at that, a real quote-unquote space station. And interesting enough, right? I mean, it serves as a plot point. It's really big because we know Cyrano Jones is going to take forever and a day to clean up all the tribbles, right? It's just enormous in size and scope, and it's tough to capture that. But, you know, I thought that it was kind of cool for Star Trek to go into that direction. They set it up, I thought, pretty cool with the Klingons and it being a shelter for anyone who wishes to come aboard, right? That's kind of the part of the Organian peace treaty. And I think that's the first time we actually hear the peace treaty being announced in the show.
Right, a rare bit of continuity from the original series where they reference something that happened in a previous episode. You know, this is a very, you know, different environment than we get to see a lot of times on, you know, the original series. Because, again, they're out there in space, they're on the Enterprise, they're by themselves. They're not interacting with just other Earth cultures or Earth people or situations like that. So, you know, there's like a bar here, people are hanging out. It's a very relaxed environment, right?
Right, and I think when Deep Space Nine recreated it, it gave it some scale, right? Because you could see both the Enterprise and the Klingon warship kind of orbiting it. And then in the remastered version, I don't know if they used the same clips or not, but they look...
They didn't, but I'll tell you this, as been established on this podcast, I always prefer physical models, so I much do prefer the trials and tribulations recreations of these ships and models and situations. Not to say the remaster is bad or anything, but just like, oh man, that's the kind of stuff that makes me wish they, makes me wish they use models for Star Trek Remastered, because it looks so good on Deep Space Nine.
Well, what was the difference? I'm trying to remember. I think I've seen Trials and Tribulations. That was the latest one I've seen, and I thought it looked pretty good. And the Enterprise looked really good, especially when they show it up on the screen. But compared to the remastered version, what were some of the things that you noticed that were different?
Well, I can't list off exact shots or anything like that, because remastered, they were on a very tight budget. They didn't get near the amount of time or resources to do what they really wanted to do. I mean, the Okudas have talked about all the fun things they really wish they could have had time for. They did a lot of stuff like on their own time, like overtime, just because they were such big fans. So look, not to slight the remastered team at all for what they had to do, but it looks like 2000 CGI. It's like, okay, that's what that looks like. That's television CGI, that's fine. But when you have models there and the lighting and the way it plays off, there's something in the back of your mind that knows that's really there. That's a physical thing. And to me, that's what makes it stand out more than the remastered version. So of the two, I prefer the Deep Space Nine. But of course, the remaster just looks a lot better than the original series, because, they were on a shoestring budget. Talk about the remastered having limited resources. The original series had like no resources at the time.
Oh, I know it. Yeah. And that's probably the toughest one, but it's, it served its purpose for the storytelling.
To them for actually making the model though. Right. I mean, that's going above and beyond, and it's a very creative design. It doesn't look like it's not like they kit bashed the Enterprise into this, right? They didn't do what they did on the Doomsday Machine, where they like, okay, let's go down to the store, let's get a model, let's figure out how to put this thing back together. This is a unique design. You have the cones and the bubbles that stick out on the arms. So, it's pretty progressive. And it looks almost like a proto Deep Space Nine. I wonder if when they were designing Deep Space Nine, they looked back to K7 for some inspiration, because you have like the pylons and the center hub, if you will. And I can see, I know it's supposed to be a Cardassian station and all that, but I'm talking about outside of the universe of Star Trek, behind the scenes, the creative process. I'm pretty sure they used this as a point of reference when they came to draft up what Deep Space Nine would look like in the 90s.
I think from a just from an overall space station point of view design that goes beyond Star Trek and other series and shows, that is kind of a common thing to have, these long corridors out to the docking bay. And you're right. Even though they weren't docking bays per se, there was nothing to indicate that the ship could come alongside, as they just beamed over and back and forth all the time. But you're right. That design was pretty cool, and I think it did kind of set a. I'm trying to think if there was anything before that, and no, I'm not quite that old, but I don't remember things before Star Trek or other space stations that kind of had that. I might have. I'm thinking. Like 2001, that was afterwards, that kind of had, kind of a hub and spoke look to it. But at any rate, it was neat. It started, getting people to appreciate Star Trek and showing for the first time, that there were outposts out there. I mean, we have the asteroids from a Balance of Terror and stuff, where we see a picture, but we don't really see what the outpost looks like, it was pretty cool.
Would you have wanted to see the Enterprise dock with K7? That would have been cool, huh?
I like that idea. Yeah. I love it in the movies and the shows, where they actually do come alongside and they do dock, and you have the boarding ramps and all that stuff. And, they did a nice job of that in TNG when they took, we'll get into that, but just kind of that whole look and feel of people walking through. You don't even get that really in Star Trek III. They just kind of show up, but right. I assume that they're dark. But at any rate, yeah, we'll get into that later. So the next time we see a space dock is the movies, except in the Ultimate Computer Remastered Edition, right? Or did they show K7 in that?
Yeah, so in the Ultimate Computer, they go to, a starbase, and they use stock footage from The Trouble with Tribbles, also another Season 2 TOS episode, and it's K7 again, right? It's like, okay, but hey, that's cool. Like, I don't mind that. Again, the continuity of like, oh, okay, all the starships look alike, all the spaceships look alike, it creates a realness to this world that there's a continuity in design. And that's, if you extrapolate that into the real world, when you go places, all the battleships look the same. So that's how it works. So I like that. But they did took this opportunity when the remastered team got to do the Ultimate Computer, which is one of the episodes that everybody was looking forward to most for the remastered, because the Ultimate Computer, infamous for their stock footage use. There's like it's not even a split screen, it's like a quad screen, right, of like four Enterprise models coming at you, and it's clearly the same shot, and it's like, oh guys, I know you're trying, but that so we with the, you know, one of the best episodes of remastered, I think, really showing off what they could do with more time, more creativity, more creative license. You know, I'm always giving CGI a hard time. Right now I'm gonna step back and say, you know what, I'm glad we had the CGI in order to show all these different angles, because, you know, if you have to do a model shot, you know, have to set up all these multiple angles and all this, it takes a lot of time. If you're on a TV budget, you're on the clock. So they had the opportunity to show different angles of these different ships. You know, there's the Excalibur in there. There's the Potemkin. There's, you know, four other ships other than the Enterprise that are coming at you. So they just went all out for this episode. This is one of the later remasters episodes. You know, the longer they went, the more time they could spend on the little details. And one of those little details was updating the space station here. So it's not K-7 anymore. It's Starbase 6, although this label is not, it's not readable in any of the shots, but, you know, we now know it as Starbase 6. And it's definitely from the same family as K-7. If you guys have seen the remastered version, you know what I'm talking about. It's like the center hub is a lot bigger and a lot longer. And then the little arms are a little shorter. So it's just like another configuration. I would compare it to, you know, the Enterprise and the Reliant, you know, from Star Trek 2. That would be like K-7 and Starbase 6 here. And they actually took this design and used it for Starbase 47 and the Vanguard novels by David Mack. That's a very popular series of novels about, you know, a space station in the original series era. You know, basically like, you know, a Deep Space Nine kind of storytelling, but in the 23rd century. And so, you know, if you go to your local bookstore and look on the bookshelf in the sci-fi section, the Star Trek section, you'll see a lot of these books, and you'll see this Starbase design on the covers.
Well, which came first, the novels or the remastered version? I'm assuming the novels came first.
The remastered version.
Oh, it did? Oh, okay.
We had the animated series, and then we had the remastered version of Star Trek get inspiration from the animated series and various starship designs, right? And then it turns back around, and we have, you know, Star Trek, other media of Star Trek, like the novels, taking inspiration from remastered. So I like cool. It keeps that strain of, you know, the Star Trek flavor going throughout across all the media. So a very small part of this episode, because, you know, they stop, they go, the Starbase doesn't play a big role. But just another cool thing that they went above and beyond for on Star Trek Remastered. So, because I'm worried sometimes I sound a little too negative about Star Trek Remastered, but because I like models, and that's been well established. That's my thing. But they did some really cool little things, really going above and beyond like that. That's a nice little touch they did for the Ultimate Computer.
Yeah, I hear you, and you're fairly consistent. And when we talked about practically CGI, when that was a fun episode. I think we talked about the ability for CGI to enhance and to improve, and that's what they did with this, and that's perfectly fine. And if you take it back a step from what they did with K-7 and the three different versions we now see, you know, there's just no doubt about it that a real tangible model holds up better than a CGI duplicate of that same model. Well, let's say from the late 70s on up, it does. It struggles a little bit. I wouldn't say the original K-7 is as good as the computer-generated version in the remastered. But I get where you're going with that, Zach, and I think it's fair, because when you have that right mix, you can tell, and you're not susceptible, I guess, to how quickly technology improves and can take away from it. But they did it right with this. They really did. It was kind of cool. Okay, so let's say so long to the television series. We move on to the movie era, and the first space station that we get to see right up in right front and close and personal is Epsilon 9 from Star Trek: The Motion Picture, which I guess is an outpost and a communications relay station, and it's pretty dang big, and it's blue, and it's got a lot of girders, and I don't think it is until the director's cut that you get kind of a better full look at it, or when Spock is going through V'ger, you kind of get a pieces of it, but it's as it gets swallowed up by the cloud, you can see that this is one big massive station. Very small control room, by the way, but a very large station.
Yeah, the thing about Epsilon 9 is, it, like you said, Ken, you don't really get a good look at it until, you know, ironically, after it's already been, you know, assimilated by V'ger, when Spock is passing over it. It's like the Epsilon 9 station recreated here in every detail. Right. And they, you know, they love showing off the special effects in the motion picture, and they had such intricate models here. You know, I mean, talking about the continuity of the original series, you know, this one, it looks nothing like any, like, starship design, but at the same time, that's kind of cool. It's just, because the motion picture was about showing us things we had never seen before, and we certainly had never seen anything like this. And I could get, you get the vibe that it's, that is like a relay station. It has a lot of which can be perceived as, you know, receivers and transmitters, and that's its function. So it's a very functional station. Like, you're joking about the small control room. People don't go there for, you know, the leisure of it all. They go there to, I guess these people live here, right? I mean, unless...
Well, sure. And, right? And, yeah. And to your point, right, it's right on the Klingon boundary, so I'm sure it's loaded with sensors and scanning, and, you know, it's trying to keep a track on what the quote-unquote bad guys are up to. And you look at the their ability to intercept the communications from the Klingon warship back to Kronos or wherever it was transmitting about what was engaging is going on was a huge tactical advantage for the Federation, right? Gave them forewarning that this big cloud was coming and demonstration of its power. So it served its purpose when they said it was going to enter space quite close to them. Well, they really weren't kidding, you know, close being a relevant term in space where you could say, well, you know, it's an astronomical unit away. It's 10 light years away, and that's relatively close. No, this thing just, it came right up on it. It ate it right up. So it, kind of interesting there. But yeah, I thought it was very practical in its design for what it did. It made sense. And, you know, just it kind of gave that perspective of awe. It's like, well, look at this technology and look what we can do. This is not K7, folks.
I wonder if they ever made a model of Epsilon 9. I mean, I'm sure they did at some point. I'll have to go look that up. If anybody knows in the Babel conference, let us know. Show us your model you put together of Epsilon 9 if you have it.
I've never seen a model of it.
That would be such like an undercover Star Trek model to have, like if you worked at like NASA or some science administration, you just put that on your desk and people will think like, oh, this must be what they're working on. But, you know, if you're a true Star Trek fan, you're like, oh, it's Epsilon 9. You know, that's like a, the Star Trek litmus test. If somebody's like, excuse me, sir, is that from Star Trek the Motion Picture? So I would love to have that model and put it on my desk. It'd be a fun one to put together, too.
You might be able to just pick up an Erector set and reconstruct the thing.
That's true. You can probably find all the pieces you need there. But that's not the only space station in Star Trek the Motion Picture, is it, Ken?
No, it's not. We have... the way I phrase in this is the Space Yard Command Earth Orbit Space Dock, right? That's outside of the Enterprise, kind of refitting it. It's I don't know if it's just an orbital platform. So the work, I guess it's where the work teams, you know, come and go and carry their gear and so forth back to the Enterprise. And
right, because the Enterprise is in dry dock at this point. I always found it an interesting separation of terms back when, you know, a young lad I was reading the Star Trek Encyclopedia every day, learning about Star Trek. There was dry dock, which is in Star Trek the Motion Picture and Star Trek II, and then space dock, which we'll get to here soon, folks, and Star Trek III onward. But they're different. They're not the same thing. So obviously dry dock is just, it's a shell. That's all it is, to hold the ship there. And I assume all the people that, you know, all the guys and the little worker bee shuttles and the guys in the spacesuits, they all, their base of operations is this orbital complex that we're talking about here. I assume they come back and forth. I mean, that's where Kirk goes to. He beams up there to fly over to the Enterprise. So, you know, they have a cool looking transporter room, I guess, but that's really all we get to see of it.
Well, we get to see a lot of the outside, and it's pretty intricate. And, you know, they do a pretty good job of showing shuttles and containers leaving it. They show a worker bee carrying, looks like almost like a solar panel or something, right at the beginning, kind of orbiting it. And what was kind of a really cool shot, one of the first ones I remember in space, was kind of the outside in, right? So when Kirk was beaming up, the camera's actually coming through the porthole. At the very beginning, so they spent a lot of time looking at it, and they put a lot of effort into it, and it has a long life, as we'll find out. But it I thought it was really cool, and they, you know, it had a lot of It had a lot of rings too, if you remember. It obviously it's stripped a lot when it's used again, but in this version, it had a tremendous amount of, or it seemed to be anyway. I guess kind of like K7. You know, it had the
right. It has a central hub and the little arms to stick out.
Yeah,
it looks like rings. An upside down Apollo module. You know, the little like conical bottom module, and then it has the little, I guess what. They're not spheres, but the circular, you know, things that stick out. So what are those? Who knows? I'm sure there's a Star Trek technical manual somewhere that can explain all the operations of those things. But it's cool. And you know, you mentioned 2001 earlier, Ken, and that's where the motion picture got a lot of its inspiration, clearly. It was trying to be 2001: A Space Odyssey, for better or for worse, in some people's opinions. But, you know, that's why we spend all this time on these models like this. You know, it reminds me of, you know, 2001, the wheel-looking thing that's right. On all the posters and all that. That's not the main ship. That's not the Discovery, which is the ship from 2001. That's just right. A space station that they spend a few minutes at and you go about your business. And that's what this reminded me of. Like, we're gonna spend some time, this is space, look at this, isn't this cool? Okay, on to our main ship now. So that's where they're coming from with it. And you know, again, I love models, right? So cool to see another model in the Star Trek movie.
Yeah, it's a great model. I think a piece of it too is, you know, we've had Star Wars and we had a couple of, well, many ripoffs after Star Wars that came out. But it was the first time that kind of showed Earthbound futuristic technology to that level, right? So that was kind of a neat thing they did with it, I thought. So, okay. And so if we move to Star Trek II, we happen to see this model you love again, don't we, Zach?
Yeah, just turn it upside down. You know, there's no up and down in space, so this makes sense, I guess. The regular one space station is this same model we were talking about from the motion picture. Again, and the motion picture doesn't have a name, so it's going to be hard to refer to the two of them back and forth, but we'll call it Regula Zero for the sake of conversation and Regula One here. So do you prefer the Regula Zero from the motion picture or Regula One from the Wrath of Khan? Up or down, Ken? What's your preference?
I like the motion picture version of it.
Of course you do. Of course you do.
I know. I love the motion picture. I get it. But the reason why is, one, I don't know if it's, you know, sharp eyes, sharp mind, whatever it was back in the day, but it was very easy to pick up what they did with that model. It wasn't sophisticated enough where it was. They made a huge effort to hide it. And because I remember the details in the motion picture, the color was bright. The arms with the discs and the different living platforms, if you call it, or office complex, it was just more intricate. And when they took all that stuff away, I think they enhanced its size. I think Regula One was supposed to be a lot bigger. That would be my guess than the Earth space dock. You know, it was kind of plain Jane, but it was fine. It served its purpose just fine. It, you know, no issues there. But as far as technically how it looked and things like that, I just think that it had such an awesome introduction in the motion picture that its reintroduction as kind of a scaled down version of that same thing flipped. It was cool. It's Regula One. I don't always look at it and say, oh, they should have left it alone, or they could have used the same model. Perhaps they could have, but it served its purpose. But I like the original look of it.
It's just interesting to me that you can turn it upside down and it totally makes sense.
Sure.
Right? You don't look at it and say, oh, that looks wrong. Like, either way it looks perfectly fine. And that's just a very interesting design. Clearly it was designed one way. And then they decided, I mean, they were already using literally stock footage from the motion picture. If they're going to reuse a model, they said, well, maybe we can customize this a bit and get it, you know, make it not so cut and paste. And, you know, good for them. I mean, it looks like they put some antennas at the top of it, which, you know, in Regula Zero was the bottom, in Regula One it's the top. So that implies some kind of, you know, transmitter thing you see on all these domes and dishes around, you know, just technology. And, you know, we see it so often here, this same model, the Regula One configuration, if you will, moving forward to Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, that I'm just so used to seeing it that way. That's my preference. I mean, we see it in some, you know, famous episodes like The Measure of a Man. That's the starbase they go to. The episode where Data's on trial, his sentience, his right to choose. One of the best episodes of The Next Generation. So that's where that trial takes place, on that starbase there. And then, of course, we see it a few times in Deep Space Nine. It's where Eddington is in jail later on in season 5 of Deep Space Nine. Spoilers. and you know, we see it crop up a few times in Star Trek. And again, I like that. I like that continuity for a smaller scale starbase. It's pretty cool. I like it.
Well, they. I also think in Deep Space Nine, wasn't it the same model they used as their headquarters after they left Deep Space Nine? And they thought they just painted it white and they scaled it up.
Did they paint it?
I thought it was white.
Sure, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I haven't watched the Deep Space Nine occupation arc in a while, but I do remember the Defiant is in that, like, in the central hub, and that kind of threw me off. Like, oh, so that's what that is. Ships go in there, but the Defiant's really small. But all these things are small, different.
But yeah, that's how I kind of took it. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. Like I said, the model definitely served its purpose, and you wouldn't have been able to flip it with all the office components and all those spires and arms and discs. It wouldn't have worked. Obviously, it would have been that apparent. But yeah, hey, you know, like I said, that's kind of the thing, and you can play with the scale, and you can make it look any way you want. So don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of Regular One and its use going forward, and I think as a TOS fan. You like to see your stuff being used over and over because it's just like, you know, there's just a lot of it. We talk about how cheap the original series was. Well, there's being cheap and not having a lot of budget. And there's also being restrainful and using your money accordingly and being innovative, right? I was watching Relics again, right? Remember we did the whole Starship show where we talk about where models are used over and over? And I was like, oh my goodness, that's from Star Trek III, and they just put engines on the side. You know, they put
on the nacelles. The Janolan. Yeah.
On the Janolan, yeah. And I just went, oh, okay. So I was like, dang, this ship, you know, gets a lot of use. And it's kind of funny. And I always kind of smile at that and just kind of go, okay, you know, just remember, folks, a lot of things that you saw and enjoyed in a lot of those series come from these movies. And being frugal is kind of a Star Trek method of doing things for all the right reasons. And it hasn't been until the most recent movies where they've really just been, you know, wide open the pocketbook there. But anyway, so leaving Regular One, in Star Trek III, now we really start to see them change the scale and scope of what you said was space dock, no longer dry dock, right? Just an enormous orbiting space dock that we see a lot. And boy, it's funny because they leave dry dock and come back to space dock.
It's like, were they building this the whole time? That's kind of the way my fanboy justification is. Oh, well, you know, space dock was under construction during Star Trek 1 and 2. That's what I think.
Either that, it was just on the other side. I don't know. You know, it was pretty interesting, because you would have thought that the Excelsior would have been in a dry dock type situation versus a space dock. But
yeah, like the Enterprise B is in Generations. You know, it's the same thing. But that's weird. So space dock here, right? It's introduced in Star Trek 3. Yep. We see it in 4, 5, 6. We see it in the Next Generation. I don't think we see it in Deep Space Nine, to be honest, or nope. Voyager. I know Voyager, they go back to Utopia Planitia.
And it's all dry docks.
Yeah, it's all dry docks. Nemesis, we see dry dock. You know, the Enterprise E comes home after getting really messed up at the end of Nemesis.
And all good things, we see D in dry dock.
Oh, right? Is that not McKinley Station?
Was it McKinley?
Yeah.
Yeah, but didn't it have a...
Well, it's like an octopus sitting on top of the saucer section.
Oh, you're right.
Which at the time I thought, oh, this is the 21st century equivalent of a dry dock. But apparently it's not because dry docks are still there, you know, in the late 24th century with the Voyager and...
Yeah, you're right.
Nemesis and all that. But so it's interesting to me that they... I guess where I was going with that was interesting to me they did not go back to space dock again for Generations. You know, I mean, they went back to dry dock, which is kind of a cool callback to their first. I mean, when I first saw Enterprise B in dry dock, you think, oh, that's cool. Just like in the motion picture, we saw the first Enterprise refit. But then you think, oh, well the last like five movies, you know, we've gotten space dock. So what's up with that? And what, you know, I guess the problem was they could not time the champagne bottle flying through space. They have to open the doors to space dock, you know, have to close.
Well, first of all, the design of Space Dock is very impressive. And it, you know, as we talked about when we did Star Trek III, kind of the origins, we kind of hit on this a little bit, that it's used a lot. And it's a great design. It's very practical. I thought it was interesting that the scale of the Space Dock and how, you know, you obviously there's a big difference between the Enterprise A or the Enterprise refit and the Enterprise D. So I assume the Space Dock, wherever they were going, where they were in that episode 1011011.
1100101. Yes.
That one. The Enterprise D obviously fits in there no problem, and it looked like it had to be a bigger.
I know that there was some behind the scenes discussion about this for that Next Generation episode. It was like, yeah, we know that it was the Enterprise A or the original Enterprise, but look, we have this footage, we can use it. Just go with us here, guys, and I'm glad they did.
So what do they do? Just superimpose the D?
Yeah. So they use, if you actually look at the shot of the Enterprise, you know, the original Enterprise, you know, from Star Trek III, where it's going into Space Dock and then coming in and coming out. All the other composites were from Star Trek III. They just removed the original Enterprise and put in the Enterprise D. So if you look at those scenes back on, like, back to back or just split screen or whatever, the Enterprise D is going on the same exact path that the original Enterprise is going, and you see the Earth, the Moon, you see everything. It's the same shot. They just put the Enterprise in. That's my understanding of how they did it. That's the way it seems to me, based off my knowledge of, you know, post production. But I am willing to stand corrected if I am wrong about that. But yeah, that's why they were able to do that, because, you know, Next Generation is starting out. All they had was access to the models and some stock footage from, you know, the first 3-4 movies. You know, that's why we saw the Klingon battlecruiser in the first couple of seasons of Next Generation. Stuff like that. So I'm glad they did, because I like Space Dock. And man, it, like you said, it has to be huge in there. Because not only does it, you know, the Enterprise, you know, the original Enterprise is pretty big. The Enterprise D is even bigger. But, you know, we're TOS here. Let's focus in on the original series movies. The Enterprise, there's a door that it goes in, right? But then once it gets in, it's like this huge space. Like, you could probably fit 10 ships in there, huh?
That's right. Now, you know, you think about the size of the Excelsior, and then you had whatever was going to become the 1701A on the other side.
I guess it's in there somewhere, right?
Yeah, it's in there, right? Whether it's the Tai Ho or whatever they call it, and there's, you know, it's funny from book to, that is one thing from a canon point of view. It seems really messed up. Like they took an old Constitution class refit Enterprise and they renamed it to, no, it's a brand new starship, which that seemed to be what the movie was implying. And, you know, they put it together so fast, it didn't work very well. Right? That's why Star Trek V is what it is. But at any rate, that ship was off to the right somewhere of the Excelsior. And then I think in one scene, you can kind of see a Reliant vessel or a similar starship on the left. So yeah,
well,
I
think
massive.
what you're talking about there is the original one of the original models that they were going to use for Star Trek Phase Two. The Enterprise, the unused Enterprise model, is used in Space Dock there. You actually get to see it. That's one of the only other ships you see in Space Dock there. And if you've seen like production art for Phase Two or even Planet of the Titans, the canceled Star Trek movie before Star Trek the Motion Picture, I'm not sure exactly which. It's just this model that they had, and it wasn't like quite like, you know, it didn't fit anymore in the Star Trek universe, right? But they could put it in scenes where, like, okay, we need something in the background. We need to fill this scene in here. So we get to see a little bit of it here in Star Trek III when the Enterprise shows up in Space Dock. And that's, I think that's what you're talking about, Ken.
Yeah, maybe. Boy, you know, it's funny, and this is a time where we have to pull in our buddy Aaron Harvey when we talk about that timeline between Phase Two and the motion picture. So there is a movie poster with that Phase Two version of Enterprise on it, right? It's got the nacelles from the refit, it's got the dish from the old, and it's, you know, kind of a combination of the two. And it's got the whole cast and pictures on the bottom. And it's funny, I had an opportunity not that long ago to actually buy the entire cast signed poster of that Star Trek motion picture coming soon trailer with that Phase Two Enterprise on it, but I passed on it. Just wasn't my. I love the picture, but for the money they were looking for, the. But anyway,
well, I did get that poster, not the full size you were talking about, but like the a miniature size, like a you know the, a mini poster of that. And I actually like that because it's got the dish on it, you know, from the original series, but it has the refit and the cells. I'm like, man, if that was like, you know, Ken, if they ever reboot Star Trek one day, that's that should be the design they use.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. I think for the TV show, it would have worked out fine. I'm awfully prejudiced because I love the refit Enterprise, but and I think it's a better design. But what I didn't realize is that model was ever came to fruition. I hadn't read that anywhere. And I didn't realize that was in the movies or in. And I know there was a lot of prototype broken models and things like that they threw in, in the ship depot and in Wolf 359. But I never realized that ship was there. So now I'm gonna be searching for that shot of that ship in Space Dock.
As we've been talking here, I've been multitasking. I looked up the exact facts, so you guys don't have to correct us now. They call it the Flat Hull Enterprise because it's very flat. It actually looks a lot like the Discovery looks. Okay, yeah, you guys all remember all the recent discussion about the Discovery teaser.
That was just a drawing, though. They actually made that.
So Ralph McQuarrie, you know, the guy did a lot of the artwork for Star Wars, and, you know, they're still using drawing from his artwork as inspiration today in the Star Wars movies. But he made this Enterprise in the late 70s, and it was for Planet of the Titans, which was the movie that was in the works, you know, pre-motion picture, you know, phase two time. But when they decided to go forward with Phase 2, the TV show, they canceled this model design. They wanted to go, you know, more simple, more like the original series since it was going to be on the original series. So they canceled it. But they did design a model, and they had it. So they used it, you know, it wasn't quite ready for the limelight or anything, but they did use it in background images. It was a concept model, you know, proof of concept. There we go. That's the terminology I'm looking for. So that's where it came from, and that's where it is, and that's in Space Dock, which I thought was cool. And, you know, I actually am surprised that they didn't throw in, like, a Reliant-class vessel in there. Maybe viewers of the 80s would have been confused. Like, didn't that ship just blow up in the last movie? What's it doing here? Maybe they weren't familiar with the fact that this is a fleet of ships and there's only one of each. Think that might have been a factor, or no?
I don't think so. I think we would have been okay if there's one ship that we see an awful lot of, it's the Reliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we get enough of that
Boy, did they just exploit the heck out of it.
But let's talk more about space. I know we're going to standard orbit tangents. It's our thing, right? Let's talk more about Space Dock here.
Let's go back there. Yep.
I like Space Dock because it's like a whole other world up there. You know, I mean, there's like restaurants, you see bars and stuff, like people live here, maybe? I get the, if you're stationed on Space Dock, I'm sure you live there.
I got the impression that that's where Kirk met the Admiral.
Right, yeah, in the Space Dock, a bar or whatever.
Yeah, what? The Space Bar.
Yeah. Well, see, that's more like the Space Lounge, whereas McCoy goes like the Space Bar, right? It's like the knockoff Star Wars cantina that he goes in. People are playing like Tron biplanes and there's tribbles.
I guess because they went back to Kirk's quarters, I thought that McCoy was back on Earth for the bar.
Really? Maybe so.
Yeah. Hey, who knows? Doesn't matter. But yeah, it's that's.
There's a lot going on in Space Dock. That's what we're saying.
There's a lot going on, and maybe the funny farm is in Space Dock. I don't know.
Don't they have like jail cells or holding cells in like professional sports stadiums for like unruly fans and stuff?
Oh yeah, especially Philadelphia.
Yeah, well, there
you they're just so, mean in Philadelphia.
Yeah. So if they have him there, I'm sure Space Dock is a holding cell of some kind. You know, when you bring in a hostel, you know, you don't know if you're bringing in somebody, and a ship comes in and they have a hostel in their brig and they transfer them to Space Dock, you know, because you know, I remember on Star Trek The Next Generation all the time, they pick up these guest stars of the week and they foil their plan. They're like, we're going to drop you off at Starbase 579 for, you know, and I'm like, well, I'm sure they put you in one of these holding cells. So that's what I always thought that McCoy was in when they break him out in Star Trek 3. I always thought all this was on the Space Dock.
Well, it could very well be. I have no idea. Like I said, I just took it from once they went to Once they went to Kirk's quarters on Earth back in San Francisco, that's where I thought a lot of the stuff was happening, back at Starfleet HQ.
Now, if you lived in the 23rd century, would you want to live on Space Dock?
If I was always on a ship, no. If it was just a duty assignment, sure, why not? You know, yeah. you can beam home, you can do whatever you want. It's not too bad. Yeah, I would imagine that there's a lot of places to be stationed, just like Captain Sisko and that whole team, right? There's got to be support stations just like you would in the fleet. You know, there's naval support activity stations all around the world, and this is probably more akin to when exploration and you went more towards coal for ship's power. You needed coaling stations and support more than you need now because you got nuclear and you can unrep underway. So yeah, I would say that that the majority of Starfleet personnel are probably not on a ship. You know, my guess, if it was real. Anyway, all right. So are we good with space talk, or are we ready to move on to
We can clear all moorings and move out.
All right. We are leaving.
Warning, space doors are closed. Warning, space doors are closed.
Yeah, and no one's in the office.
That is my favorite. That is, you know, I often go back and forth about this. Like, favorite scenes in Star Trek, we always talk about the first scene in Star Trek 09, and probably is the favorite scene. If probably solid number two for me is the stealing the Enterprise scene from Star Trek 3.
Scene. Yeah, it is a fun scene.
But anyway, let's move on. Let's steal the Enterprise and move on to the Kelvin timeline, Ken.
Yeah. So in 09, we only see just for a second, and I think we see it in Into Darkness in the background maybe a little bit. I don't really recall. But there is an orbiting platform type space station for the fleet, right? There's four or five starships that are moored nose first onto this thing. And It's kind of interesting because when the shuttles approach the new Enterprise, it doesn't look like it's attached, but yet they clear all moorings and pull away. So I guess the very, very front of it, or somewhere along the line, they're attached to this thing, but we don't get to see it other than for a few seconds and off they go. So not a lot to say about that platform other than that's all it seems to be is a big parking spot. You know, there's no giant space dock here.
Right.
It's all external.
But it makes a lot more practical sense, though, doesn't it, than a space dock? Like, if you're going to have a ship, like, why waste the space? Because space dock has to be so big because these ships have to fit inside it. When if they're going to dock anyway, why not just attach like these do? Now, I did find it weird, like you said, like it's like saucer to saucer because this space station here, like, it, you know, it's kind of a lot like a regular Zero. From the motion picture, right, where it's got these discs that come out from the center, and that's where the ship's attached to. Obviously, much bigger than regular Zero. Let's make that a thing, everybody. Regular Zero. All right, I want everyone to refer to the motion picture space station as regular Zero from now on. But you didn't really see because talking about Rathcon when they had little pods that go in and out. Motion picture, Next Generation, when you see people walking across Enterprise D to not space dock, but the space dock design place they're docked to. It's just weird to see the ships just park saucer to saucer like that. Like, I guess there's some kind of attachment, but I would have thought they're look, we're used to what we've seen in the other Star Trek movies. I thought they're going to go side to side and they have the little bridge that pops out and all that kind of thing. But yes, interesting to see. They do different things. They do things differently in the Kelvin timelines because they did those sensor scans in the Narada and all the technology is so advanced now, Ken. That explains it all, right? So
that's right.
But they warp out of there real quick, and that's really the last we see of this new design. So
yeah, and then what I thought was really cool, because I think we can blast right past Into Darkness into Beyond. We get to the largest, most ingenious space station outpost, massive snow globe gizmo you've ever seen in Yorktown Station. It's just incredible, and obviously it's a very big focal point of the whole movie. I think it's the first thing that I liked about was its purpose, in the reason it was built, and it made sense to me, especially when. You know, you take the geopolitical aspect of what's going on in today's world, and you have the UN in New York City, and you have in Brussels and things. But it just makes sense. In order to show no favoritism whatsoever, they build this platform as a sign of unity, and not this platform, this huge space station. It's got millions, or at least a million people. I mean, it's just every I don't know what you'd call it. Every ring seems to have its own set of skyscrapers, right? Buildings and so forth. And it's, you know, it almost had a Disney feel to it, you know, as you were watching those high-speed trams zipping by.
Yeah, it was very Epcot Center, wasn't it? Yeah.
It really was. And the music was kind of flowing. And, you know, it was made as a cultural center where all these different species of the Federation come together to learn, live, build, and, you know, it has everything. I mean, it had its own fighters. It had its own protective ring of satellites. It seemed like it was pretty well protected overall. I think they definitely took it into account, and it took quite a wallop when you think about it. But just the ingeniousness of it. I mean, just watching a starship enter it, and then you're watching the ship fly through the center, through that tube, the whole nine yards. I was like, man, this thing is really cool. And you know, I don't know how many different entry and exit points it had, but yeah, I was blown away from this. I thought conceptually it was beyond, there's that word again, anything we've seen in Star Trek, but also from just a, you know, you think of Deep Space Nine, you think of Babylon 5. I'm trying to think of where, you know, you have these man-made, you know, like the Death Star, I guess, is probably bigger, but I don't know. there really wasn't much. It definitely was the most complex space station piece of technology that we've ever seen in Star Trek, and I thought they did a beautiful design, beautiful job designing it.
Yeah, I mean, talk about just practicality. I did, you know, I was talking about how space dock, like, why did you make this giant center for the spaceships to fit in? They should just dock. I was just saying that, but this makes sense because they Enterprise, they go in this, you know, pathway, and then and they just kind of stay in this tube, if you will, you know, once they get in there. And that's a nice logical place to store spaceships, because obviously there's gonna be a lot of dead space inside this spherical star-based planet. I assume all this stuff is on the inside, like, you know, where the planet core would be if it was a real planet. But since it's not, they can take advantage of all this space, and that's where they store all the starships. You know, they're building starships there. I mean, we were talking about how they were allegedly constructing or refitting the Yorktown into the Enterprise A back in space dock. Well, here they actually mentioned that they were, you know, building their next ship, right. And that obviously becomes the Enterprise A. It was, I don't know if they mentioned in the movie that it's supposed to be the Yorktown or not, but
they never they just said it's a that they're building a the only starship that had better capabilities than the Enterprise was still under construction, is how
exactly,
they worded
yeah,
it.
So
they didn't have a name for it. No.
So it's interesting that this has many purposes, right? And I really like that as well, how the logic of Spock explaining to McCoy, like, you know, due to the geopolitical reasons that they don't want to show favoritism by being on a planet. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, who says the Kelvin timeline films are not relevant to today's, you know, political atmosphere or cultural situations going on? I thought it was a very clever, very subtle thing to address, as you said. And, you know, they have that. They have starship construction going on. It's just a very lively place. People can you can go outside, and there's a sky, and there's grass, and there's kind of like a Dyson sphere, I guess, right? Because is there a sun? Where does this light come from? I don't know. But I really
like it. It must be in orbit over something. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's true. The planet's around, or the sun that's around. That's true. So did you think this was just kind of took the gravitational, like, rotation of a planet? Is that what you're thinking, Ken?
I don't know. I guess I haven't thought through it as much. I assume because of its shape that it can do that. One of the things that I have in my head, Ken, and which makes me really appreciate the Yorktown design, is that so many different planets come together to build this thing. And that helps me kind of justify not only its existence, but its sophistication, right?
It's good point.
You know, we definitely look at a lot of the technology in Star Trek, which was always kind of confusing for me. And I know Enterprise addresses it better. But, you know, it isn't until there's a lot of conflicts in Enterprise and so forth that there's a real sharing of technology. To me, it always seemed much more plausible that all these warp drive societies come together and you're able to enhance your technology. It isn't, you know, an Earth ship, a Vulcan ship, or this ship or that ship. It's a Federation ship. And this, to me, is a true Federation outpost with the best of all worlds incorporated in it. And, you know, when you talk about Star Trek Utopia, you do not see it anywhere in any episode of Star Trek. You really don't. You make a few landings on Earth. It's usually at the Academy or maybe Sisko's dad's restaurant. But you don't see it. You don't feel it. You just are told about it, right? That it's a paradise and Earth has become a paradise. This is the first time you see Federation, quote unquote, kind of a united, you know, peoples all in one spot, you know, clean, safe, accepting, you know, aliens walking around and everything, and they don't do it like a cheap Star Wars ripoff at all. You know, you kind of feel like this is what it is. This is what they, you know, they've been intending to have all along. And to me, that's the greatest thing about Yorktown Station and its concept. It's the only place in Star Trek we see what they've been telling us we've had.
Wow. Well, that's hard to top right there, Ken. I don't know what else I can add to that, because that is an excellent point about how this is like Star Trek and its philosophy just epitomized in this space station. And that's why Beyond is a great Star Trek movie. You know, it really is for many reasons, but little things like that too. It's like, here's the Federation. Like, we can finally show it to you. We have the budget. We have the technology. Here it is, guys. Here's the future we could have. So that's, you know, that's great to see. And, you know, knock on wood, we're going to get some more Star Trek Kelvin timeline movies, and, you know, maybe we can see more space stations like this, the Yorktown, maybe the Yorktown again, maybe something similar in the future. I know it's the most advanced, but clearly the next movie will take place a little bit in the future, so we can stop on by. I just want to stop on by, though. I don't want to spend the whole time there, right? I like a movie in deep space. Let's just stop on by, see what's up, and go about our business. But, you know, these space stations really, they just give scope. They really paint the greater canvas of the Star Trek universe, because if everybody was just in a spaceship the whole time, like you were saying, you wouldn't get to see any of this stuff. So that's cool. It really fleshes out the Star Trek universe, gives us more toys to buy, models to build as well.
Is there a Yorktown model out there?
Oh, man. I don't want to put that thing together. If you want a project, that's one to put together. Goodness gracious. Well, it's been fun discussing Star Trek space stations and everything in between this week on Standard Orbit. But this isn't the only thing that's being talked about on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Wow, that was very Kirk. You had a lot of pauses in there. I like that.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Sugar and spice and everything nice, yes, we know. But that's never mentioned in the episode at all. Like, you think there would be some tag scene with everybody on the bridge and Kirk saying that to himself, and Spock says, "Spice, Captain," or something like that, right?
I guess so.
Earl Grey.
And then as kind of a teenager, I kind of drifted a bit from Star Trek, and, you know, I pretended one time when I went to see Star Trek Nemesis that I was actually off to see Elf instead, because that sounded cooler than seeing Star Trek Nemesis. And maybe it still is.
To the journey!
See, now I'm picturing, like, old Seven of Nine at the end of Titanic. You know, she's got the doctor's medical tricorder in her hand, and she lovingly tosses it over the side of the ship at the end of the episode.
Oh, no, she has the mobile emitter.
She takes the doctor's mobile emitter and throws it overboard.
Perfect. I love this.
The 602 Club.
I thought it was a great story about, you know, perseverance and the courage to act, even when you don't know how the outcome's going to come.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscribe button. That makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes and helps us increase our visibility for new listeners.
If you'd like to get in touch with us here at trek.fm, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm, facebook.com/trekfm, and the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
So let me talk to you for a second about Patreon, Zach. Patreon is the program that Trek FM employs in order to get donations to keep the network coming to you commercial-free. It is wonderful. Most of the hosts here on Trek FM are big contributors to Patreon and found our way onto the network through Patreon. So if you can spare any money, and we don't care what the denomination is, it really means a lot to us because there is a lot of content that we're putting up there, a lot of bandwidth, a lot of programming, a lot of equipment that we need. So please, if you can help us out, we'd appreciate it. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and you can click any donation you want. And we do have some incentives for you. So for $15 a month, you get to join the Patrons Roundtable where you podcast. And you know, again, that is where a lot of us started. It was on the Roundtable. I was on the very first one. I had a blast. And if you can contribute $25 or more per month, then you get associate producer credits for whatever show you like. And we love our associate producers. So please, 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 if you have the ability, it is more than appreciated. And speaking of our associate producers, we'd like to thank Renee Roberts and Aaron Harvey. Thank you so much, always, for your support for both Standard Orbit and the Trek FM network. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701, and you can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at GeekFilter. So if you're looking for me on the network, you can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm always on there, pre, post shows, talking different subjects with all our listeners. And you can also find me on Twitter at Boston, SCPO. That means Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreonZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show from the early 2000s. And we're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And also, I'm around the Babel Conference as well. It's always great to talk to you guys on there, making conversation about our shows, other shows, general Star Trek topics, anything, really. Love to talk to you guys on there. So thanks for listening, everyone. And join us again next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit.